and Chris, and this is my Writing Table podcast, where we talk to authors and other creatives about the writing world and what it takes to create the books that we love to read. Ready? Pull up a chair and let's begin. And you're listening to my Writing Table podcast. Kelly J. Ford is the Anthony-nominated author of Real Bad Things and Cottonmouths, a Los Angeles Review Best Book of 2017. Kelly writes crime fiction set in the Ozarks and the Arkansas River Valley. Her latest novel is The Hunt.
Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you. It's good to be back talking with you.
I have a special surprise for you. I start doing for veteran guests. We have a fun little lightning round before you take off. Let's talk about your latest novel, The Hunt. I have to ask, what do you have against the Easter Bunny?
Nothing. I love the Easter Bunny. You know, no problems whatsoever. You know, the book is based on my favorite radio station growing up was Kisser 93.7 in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And they always did a hunt for the golden egg, or it was like the golden keys or something like that.
Yeah.
And I never went on one, but the DJ's voice, I think it was Rick. It's always Rick, right? The DJ.
Yeah.
And sorry, Rick, if that's not your name, but he had this, like, he could have been a great narrator for horror novels. Because it was just this deep voice that it scared me as a kid. And I don't know why, that just always stuck with me. Easter egg hunts were always a little bit sinister to me.
Nothing against like radio DJs, but you hear their voices. A few times I've met the radio DJs and they were a little different than I had pictured them.
Yes,
a little,
for sure.
And I could see how they could fit into maybe a little mystery. That's all I'm saying.
Right? I mean, it's just ripe for a crime novel.
Absolutely. Tell us about The Hunt.
So, yes, as I mentioned, it's based on the Easter egg hunt. It's fictional, but it is based on my hometown hunt. In this fictionalized version, it's set in a fictionalized town, Presley, Arkansas, where for 17 years, the radio station has put on the hunt for the golden egg, and with each year getting bigger and bigger prizes. And for Arkansas and for a lot of us, it's like life-changing money, you know, but this is the biggest one. It's like the first one after COVID. So they took some time off. So there are people in town who are really for the hunt and love it because they love the chase. But then there are also factions in town who believe that a series of disappearances and people dying are associated with the hunt. And they believe that there's a serial killer that uses the hunt as their praying ground.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Where did you get this? I mean, I know you said the radio station, right. But like, I know it's that question that people ask authors all the time. Where do you get these ideas?
But, you know,
I mean, for someone who writes what you write, it's like, where do you get these ideas?
I have to say, when I was first starting out, you know, in writing classes and stuff, I was always like, oh, you got to be serious. You know, I took literature classes like English lit. You know, like the Wayback Machine, we're going 1800s, 1900s. It's like, oh God, I just love absurd things. And somehow the absurdity always bubbles up in my brain. And obviously a sinister Easter egg hunt is pretty absurd. But I also have had, you know, some of these characters in various novels before and just kind of percolating and kind of like, I see my characters as kind of these great actors. You know, it's like in my mind, you know, they're not Meryl Streep. As long as you have a great character, like you can put them in any world, like they take on a life of their own, like a great actor. So yeah, I've had some of these characters kind of percolating in my brain for years. And I was like, oh, wait, no. This makes perfect sense. You know, one of the characters, they lost a family member in a previous novel, unpublished novel, you know, trunk novels in a way, I guess. But this is a serial killer novel. So obviously, let's mash that up. So, nothing in my brain makes sense.
I tell my husband all the time, I just continually shocked at how the subconscious writes books for
us.
Because I have no clue where some of this stuff comes from. And, you know, right now I'm writing one that has a crime associated with it. And I'll be talking to friends. I'm like, do you know that somebody that this happened to? Or I'll be telling them, wait, Are you talking about something that really happened?
I know.
No, I'm just that wackadoodle that I came up with this.
That is the most fun part of writing, I think, because it is true. Your subconscious goes, and when you get into kind of that trance state, I don't know if you do, but for me, it's like this trance state where it's like hours can go by, and then it's kind of like I lift up my head. Like maybe I've lifted my head since then. I could have gone to the bathroom. I wouldn't even know because I'm just in the zone. And then you read it back and you're like, what the hell? what is going on in my brain?
Back when I lived in Texas, I had been writing all day. It was one of those days where I got up like in my jammies before my husband went to work. And I wrote, I don't even know that I got dressed. Like, I think I was still in my jammies all day. And he came in and I look at the clock. It was like 2 p.m. I go, what are you doing home so early? Sometimes on Fridays, he would get off early. And I said, you have afternoon office today. It's Wednesday. And he said, no, Chris, it's Friday. Like, you don't even know what day it is.
Yeah. Like,
I had a good day.
I guess I should go shower off. That's how you know.
Right. First of all, about the hunt, I had a couple things I want to talk to you about and a couple things that came up today. The cover of this book is so cool. I mean,
I love it.
The glitter, the egg, the colors, it is dynamite. So well
Thank
done.
You.
Whoever did this and whoever approved
Rex
it.
Bonamelli. He did my cover for Real Bad Things too for Thomas and Mercer. He's so amazing. He got it one and done, you know?
If I saw this come through, I'd be like, it's done. Yeah. I mean, and there's like a real picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the hunt and the graphic superimposed. It just, it's the best of both worlds. It's gorgeous. So well
Thank
done
you.
On that. And then New York Times things where it's like, they'll ask an author a bunch of questions, you know, kind of an interview, but I think it's like a written interview. And they asked S.A. Cosby what was on his nightstand. And he mentioned a little book called The Hunt.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of nice.
That was so nice. He is, I don't know if you've had a chance to talk with him and interview him.
I have not.
He is just one of the most magnificent people. Like, beyond just a writer, he's just a really good, authentic person. He reminds me so much of just sitting down with my dad and my Uncle Larry and just listening to them tell stories all day long. Like, that's what it's like to be around Sean. It's just like, let me tell you something, you know? And he just starts talking, and it's hilarious. And he's just really down to earth and very generous toward other writers. And I was very lucky to meet him at a BoucherCon Writers Conference in Florida several years ago now. You know, we just hit it off the way he hits it off with so many people. But he's really one of those people who kind of remembers everyone he meets, too. I'm very, very grateful for his friendship and for him name dropping me in the New York Times. I'm like, it finally happened. I can say I was in the New York Times. Thanks to you, Sean. We'll see. We'll see.
I want to congratulate you. You had a lot of very positive pre-pub blurbs about this. But Midwest Book Review said some writers seem to have a natural affinity for originality and the kind of narrative-driven storytelling that immediately engages and then holds the reader's total attention from first page to last. Let me keep going.
Wow.
Clearly, with the publication of Real Bad Things, Kelly J. Ford has proven herself to be one of those novelists. So what is it that goes into creating narrative-driven storytelling?
That's such a nice thing to hear, you know, because it's like sometimes you just kind of, you're doing your day job, you're doing your thing, and you don't take the time to kind of pay attention to that, you know. But what does drive my narrative? You know, it's so hard to answer these questions because I really do feel like such a bonkers fool all the time when I sit down to write.
I mean,
like,
I see it as your voice.
You know what I mean?
You have a very distinctive writer's voice.
And I
can see why readers enjoy that. It's narrative driven. It's like you want to hear this person. It doesn't have to be the same story. Give me another story with that same voice.
I think so much of it, too, is just coming up in a storyteller culture. Mm-hmm. It's like I wasn't surrounded by writers, but I was surrounded by storytellers such as, you know, my aforementioned father and my uncle. But my entire family, we would just sit around the fire in my grandma and grandpa's dirt driveway. You know, they build a big bonfire and tell stories. And so for me, I think it was also this collaborative thing in a way where it's just like the writing itself isn't as fun as the sharing. And so that's why sometimes I prefer like thinking of it as storytelling versus writing, because I really feed off of that energy I love being an audience member. You know, I love absorbing, but it's like now I get to be the storyteller in my own way. And so part of the fun is just imagining people being like, what? Like as I'm writing, like, geez, bonkers. What is this character
Where
doing?
Where is she taking us?
Yeah. So I think that's part of it. And then also just like being really interested in various mediums. Like I did poetry for a very long time and I was super into screenwriting and I love film and TV and all that. And so it's like, I always think about it. It sounds weird, but a transactional manner, but you know what I mean? It's just that, yeah. That storyteller audience vibe where you're feeding off each other's energy. That way you get away from kind of the idea of just talking at someone.
Exactly.
Like I think about in terms of you're telling someone a story and you're doing those pregnant pauses for effect because you're just like, you ain't going to believe this shit. And then it's like, what? Give it to us.
So when you get a new idea for a new novel, you said before you kind of have these characters stewing, but when you sit down to write a novel and you go, okay, now I've finished that one, ready to start a new one. Do you kind of get the concept of the plot? And then plug in the characters, or do you say, no, I'm going to take this character somewhere and build the plot around that character?
It's kind of both. I think it depends on where I'm at in the process. I feel like I start with characters instead of plot because character is so important to me. Like I do love a lot of plot driven stories, especially TV and film. I think it, you know, obviously where they excel. But in a book, it's like, I really love that the benefit of a book is getting all the backstory. And I've said before, I love backstory, but not even that. It's like getting a context for a person, you know, and understanding who they are, where they've been, what matters to them, what freaks them out, that sort of thing. I think that's what makes stories interesting. And then it's kind of like, because you built these people and you know what their triggers are and you know what excites them and terrifies them, you can kind of put them in anything. You start the story with a premise and these characters, and it could be something like my next book I'm working on, the premise is, and this is long, many years in the making, but in my head, I'm like, it's like Frankenstein meets Fatal Attraction, right? Ooh. And I'm just like, how weird is that? Why not? So it's kind of like, oh, so it's almost like I start with characters and then a premise, and then I go from there and I just kind of let my subconscious do its thing. And then in revision is where it's in the outlining portion and trying to clarify the story in a way that makes more sense than a first draft ever can or will for me.
So do I understand you write the first draft, like you pants the first draft, or do you? I keep hearing like when you write mystery or crime fiction, any of that kind of stuff, that you have to outline. But I've talked to more and more authors that say, yeah, I kind of get it started and let them take me.
I do that with first drafts. I don't love writing first drafts, to be honest, just because I feel like I'm making the material. Like I can't just go and get some granite and start, you know, honing it. So I kind of let the first draft be as wild as it wants to be. And I don't do anything with it because for me, it's just like, this is just material that I know I'm going to have to shape. So it's after the first draft that I start my outlining. And that's only after I've read the first draft. And I go through, I learned this years ago in a writing class of just, I print out, I don't anymore. I use my iPad and I use my Apple Pencil. I go word for word and highlight sentences or pages. You know, if I like something, it's just a green, like I'm super simple. It's like traffic signals, you know, like green, go, good. You know, yellow, I can fix this, you know, maybe pause and think about it. And then I have a whole bunch of red where I'm just like, this is shit. Just go into the shredder, you know? It's a nice visual guide for me to just scan through and be like, oh, I like that. I like that. I like that. And take those pieces I like. So I sound like I'm all over the place, but I do have elements of my process that are methodical to try to keep me focused because I am all over the place.
How long is your original shitty first draft in comparison to your final?
Like word count wise?
Yeah.
first drafts are the only ones where I'm really looking at word count, because again, it's not my favorite. So I try to get it done as quickly as possible. And I feel like I'm white knuckling it sometimes. And I'm like, get to 75. Like, I feel like if I can get to 75,000, I'm good. So I set that as my goal, just to have a goal. I'm very deadline driven and goal driven. So that helps me to just put a stake in the ground and something to work toward.
And then you do the outline. So you take the stuff you're going to keep and outline it and figure out what you need to add, change, whatever. And then what, 100,000 words, something like that?
Something like that. I kind of stopped doing the word count after that.
Yeah.
Because it always expands.
When you're early in this, that word count's so important. And then you get a couple books out, it's like, okay, just get the book to us. We talked a little bit the last time we had an episode with you about living in Arkansas and your dad's text messages and how that could sometimes give you fuel for stories. Mm-hmm. How about living in Arkansas in that setting? How does that contribute to your novels?
I mean, I came of age in Arkansas. I did not leave Arkansas for Boston until I was 22. So, I mean, they were definitely my formative years. And then, of course, I had more formative years, but it's such a piece of me in terms of things like your sensory details are so tied to memory, right? So taste. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, anytime I smell bacon grease and fabric softener, I immediately think of my Grandma Ford. Like, that was just what it smelled like in our house. And so because of those formative memories, it's almost like, in some ways, I feel stuck in Arkansas memory wise, but I'm able to kind of, I mean, being away from Arkansas also helps me, because it's like I can take that camera view and pull out and really see things from a more global level for my stories that maybe I wouldn't be able to see if I were still living there. The story would be totally different. I don't know that I'd be a writer if I were still living in Arkansas. It's kind of like I had to leave. But I love Arkansas. It's like our hearts are still kind of rooted.
What are you reading?
Oh my gosh, what am I reading right now? Well, I just got Yasmin Ungo's third book in her series. I just posted it on Twitter. This one is It Ends With Night, and it's just gorgeous, and I can't wait to read that. And then I'm currently also reading Megan Abbott's latest, Beware the Woman.
Yeah.
So I love Megan Abbott's work. She's just brilliant. Those are the ones I'm focused on right now.
Are you ready to do this little lightning round?
I am.
All right. Here we go. What's the book you wish you had written?
Oh gosh, probably Kate Chopin's The Awakening, the most depressing book from my English lit classes in college, that one.
What's the movie everyone loved but you didn't dig?
Snowpiercer. I hated that movie.
You're most at home when?
I'm on the couch eating snacks and drinking wine and watching TV with my dog.
With the dog. The place you'll never go is?
That's the toughest one, because I'm a traveler. I worked in travel for 10 years
on
the
creative
side. So I'll kind of go anywhere. I can't actually think of a place I wouldn't go once, you know, because I'm very much like, let's go. Why not? It'll be a laugh. Even if it sucks, we'll get a great story out of it.
There you go. That's an important point, is you always have a great story. Your favorite carb?
That's actually the hardest one, because I'm a carb fanatic. Oh my God. I just love bread. There's this brioche bread that is so good. I do PB&Js on it. I do my Boca burgers on it, like toast, you name it. Oh, it's so good.
The sound that makes you turn inside out.
I think it's that stereotypical nails on the chalkboard. It really is just spine crackling awful.
Algebra or geometry?
Oh God, they both were awful. I have PTSD from those classes.
The world goes to hell. Who do you call?
Probably my dad.
The song that takes you back to 17.
Oh, it's probably the first thing that popped into my head. I remember just like riding in my car crying over some boy back when I was a straight girl. And it was like Aerosmith, you know, something from a movie, or I don't know. You're My Angel, or what was it? They had this real heartbreaker song. God, what was it?
Was it the one in Armageddon?
Maybe. It was a breakup song, though.
What's the lesson you learned publishing your third novel?
I think just chill out. You know, you're just kind of like, just enjoy yourself. Don't freak out. Don't feel like you have to overplan anything. Just like have conversations. I think that's the easiest thing. I think you can troll yourself up thinking that you're saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing. And then, you know, a third book comes along. You're just like, just be yourself. Just, you're just talking to interesting people. That's all you're doing. It's fun.
Any little tips you give to a new writer?
Definitely find your people. You know, going back to the beginning, right? You know, S.A. Cosby, you know, he became one of my people. But I'm very lucky that I have many people in my corner in the writing world. And I think it's so important. Writing is such a solitary pursuit, but it doesn't have to be. Even if you are living in a space where it's really hard to get out and see people, like maybe you don't have a bookstore within 100 mm-hmm. miles of you. You know, we're very lucky to live in a time when we can connect with people all over, you know. And again, it's like if you have the Wi-Fi access, right? And right, not just Wi-Fi, but internet access, it's easier. And so once I started going to writing classes and I started going to things like book readings, I've met a lot of people just going to book readings and going to conferences. I knew no one when I went to the first BoucherCon in Florida, and I felt like such a fish out of water because I didn't even know that I was a crime writer. You know, like you feel so lost. And then you just start talking to these people who are doing the same thing as you, and you realize how great that is. It seems so simple and childish in a way, but it's like, no, you know, you're just like me. You know, that's the best thing you can do, because you become friends with people at certain points in their career, and you get the honor and the privilege of watching them, watching their career grow, watching their talent grow, and mm-hmm. or just be recognized. And it's such a beautiful thing. It's not about the competition, and it's not about keeping up with the Joneses. It's just living and breathing in a community of support and just really fun, funny people who are genuine. I've been very fortunate in that regard.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm so excited about The Hunt. It's such a pretty book.
Thank you.
To learn more, visit kellyjford.com.
Music by Pavel Yudin and photography by Casey Meineke. If you like what you're hearing, hit the subscribe button and consider leaving a review.
If you're enjoying The Writing Table, please consider leaving us a review. There are so many podcasts out there. Reviews help other listeners find us. Thanks so much for your support.